Tadeo is moving up in the world of mixed martial arts, and we're all beginning to sense something big. He's lying on a table, on his stomach, naked except for his boxers, not an ounce of fat on his 130-pound body. His cousin Leo is massaging his shoulder blades. The lotion makes his light brown skin glisten. I ease around the room and speak to Norberto, his manager, Oscar, his trainer, and Miguel, his brother and workout partner. They smile when they speak to me because I, the lone gringo, am viewed as the man with the money. I'm also the agent, the guy with the connections and brains who'll get Tadeo on a UFC card if he keeps winning. There are a couple of other relatives in the background, hangers-on who have no discernible role in Tadeo's life. I don't like these extras because they expect to be paid at some point, but after 7 wins in a row, Tadeo thinks he needs the entourage. They all do. With the exception of Oscar, they're all members of the same street gang, a mid-level organization of El Salvadorans who run cocaine. Tadeo has been one of the gang since he was initiated at the age of 15, but has never aspired to a leadership position. Instead, he found some old boxing gloves, discovered a gym, and then discovered he had freakishly quick hands. His brother Miguel also boxed, but not as well. Miguel runs the gang and has a nasty reputation on the street. The more Tadeo wins, the more he earns, and the more I worry about dealing with his gang. I lean down and speak softly to him. "How's my man?" He opens his eyes, looks up, suddenly smiles, and pulls out the earphones. The massage ends abruptly as he sits on the edge of the table. We chat for a few moments, and he assures me he's ready to kill someone. Attaboy. His pre-fight ritual includes avoiding a good shave for a week, and with his scraggly beard and mop of black hair, he sort of reminds me of the great Roberto Duran. But Tadeo's roots are in El Salvador, not Panama. He's 22, a U.S. citizen, and his English is almost as good as his Spanish. His mother has documents and works in a cafeteria. She also has an apartment full of kids and relatives, and I get the impression that whatever Tadeo earns gets divided many ways. Every time I talk to Tadeo, I'm thankful I'm not forced to face him in the ring. He has fierce black pupils that scream angrily, "Show me the mayhem, show me the blood." He grew up on the streets, fighting anyone who got too close. An older brother died in a knife fight, and Tadeo is afraid he'll die too. When he steps into the ring, he's convinced someone is about to be killed, and it won't be him. His 3 losses were on points. Nobody's kicked his ass yet. He trains 4 hours a day, and he's close to mastering jiu-jitsu. His voice is low, his words slow, the usual pre-fight jitters where fear clouds all thoughts and your stomach churns. I know. I've been there. A long time ago, I had 5 Golden Gloves boxing matches. I was 1-4 until my mother found out about my secret career and mercifully brought it to an end. But I did it. I had the guts to step into the ring and get the shit knocked out of me. However, I cannot imagine the guts it takes to crawl into the cage with another fighter who's superbly conditioned, highly skilled, well-trained, hungry, nasty, and terrified, and whose only thoughts are how to rip your shoulder out of its socket, mangle your knees, open a gash, or land a knockout punch on the jaw. That's why I love this sport. It takes more courage, more in-your-face raw guts than any sport since the gladiators battled to the death. Sure, many others are dangerous. Downhill skiing, football, hockey, boxing, car racing. More people die on horses each year than in any other sport. But in those, you don't willingly enter the game knowing you will get hurt. When you walk into the cage, you will get hurt, and it could be ugly, painful, even deadly. The next round could well be your last. That's why the countdown is so brutal. The minutes drag by as the fighter fights his nerves, his bowels, his fears. The waiting is the worst part. I leave after a few minutes so Tadeo can go back into his zone. He told me once that he's able to visualize the fight, and he sees his opponent on the mat, bleeding and screaming for mercy. I weave through the maze of corridors in the depths of the arena, and I can hear the crowd roaring in echoes, thirsting for blood. I find the right door and step inside. It's a small administrative office that's been hijacked by my own little street gang. We meet before the fights and place our wagers. There are six of us, and membership is closed because we don't want any leaks. Some use their real names, others do not. Slide dresses like a street pimp and has served time for murder. Nino is a mid-level meth importer who served time for trafficking. Johnny has no criminal record, yet, and owns half of the fighter Tadeo will face tonight. DiNardo drops hints of mafia ties, but I doubt his criminal activity is that well organized. He aspires to promote MMA events and longs to live in Vegas. Frankie is the old guy, a local fixture in the fight scene for decades. He admits he's been seduced by the violence of cage fighting and now is bored with old-fashioned boxing. So, these are my boys. I wouldn't trust any of these clowns in a legitimate business deal, but then we're not doing anything legitimate. We go down the card and start the betting. I know Tadeo is going to kill Johnny's fighter, and evidently Johnny is worried. I offer $5,000 on Tadeo, and no one will take it. $3,000, and no takers. I chide them, cuss them, ridicule them, but they know Tadeo is on a roll. Johnny has to wager something, and I finally haggle him into a $4,000 bet that his fighter won't make it to the third round. DiNardo decides he wants some of this for another $4,000. We cover the card with all manner of wagers, and Frankie, the scribe, records it all. I leave the room with $12,000 in play on four different fights. We'll meet in the same room later when the fights are over and settle up, all in cash. The fights begin, and I roam around the arena, killing time. The tension in the locker room is insufferable, and I can't stand to be in there as the clock ticks along. I know that by now Tadeo is laid out on a table, motionless, covered by a thick quilt, saying his prayers to the Virgin Mary and listening to filthy Latin rap. There is nothing I can do to help, so I find a spot on an upper level, high above the ring, and take in the show. It is indeed a sellout, and the fans are as loud and crazed as ever. Cage fighting appeals to the savage instinct in some people, including me, and we're all here for the same reason, to see one fighter annihilate another. We want to see bleeding eyes, gashes across the forehead, chokeholds, bone-ripping submissions, and brutal knockout punches that send the corners scrambling for the doctor. Mix in a flood of cheap beer, and you have 5,000 maniacs begging for blood. I eventually work my way back to the locker room where things are coming to life. The first two fights ended with early knockouts, so the evening is moving quickly. Norberto, Oscar, and Miguel put on their glowing yellow jackets, same as mine, and Team Zapata is ready for the long walk to the cage. I'll be in the corner along with Norberto and Oscar, though my role is not as important. I make sure Tadeo has water while Norberto yells instructions in the fastest Spanish you'll ever hear. Oscar tends to the facial wounds, if any. From the moment we hit the floor, everything becomes a blur. Along the tunnel, drunk fans reach for Tadeo and scream his name. Cops shove people out of our way. The roar is ear-splitting. And it's not all for Tadeo. They want more, another fight, preferably one to the death. Outside the cage, an official checks Tadeo's gloves, applies oil to his face, and gives him the green light. An announcer yells his name over the PA, and our man bounces into the cage in his bright yellow trunks and robe. His opponent tonight goes by the Jackal, real name unknown and unimportant. He's a submission specialist, a tall white guy without much bulk, but looks are deceiving. I've seen him fight three times, and he's guileful and crafty. He plays defense well and looks for a takedown. He wrapped his last opponent into a pretzel and made him scream for mercy. Right now, I loathe the Jackal, but deep down, I admire the hell out of him. Any man who can climb into the cage has far more spine than the average guy. The bell rings for round one, 3 minutes of fury. Tadeo the boxer bores in straight ahead and immediately has the jackal backing up. Both jab and spar for the first minute, then tie up, but there's no damage. Like the other 5,000 fans, I'm yelling my head off, though I have no idea why. Any advice is useless, and Tadeo isn't listening anyway. They go down, land hard, and the jackal has him in a scissors hold. For a long minute, the action dies as Tadeo squirms and wiggles, and we hold our breath. He finally breaks free and manages a sharp left jab to the jackal's nose. Finally, there's blood. There's no question my man is the better fighter, but it just takes one mistake and you've got an arm twisted to the breaking point. Between rounds, Norberto unloads a torrent of instructions, but Tadeo isn't listening. He knows much more about fighting than any of us, and he's got the guy figured out. When the bell rings for round two, I grab him by the arm and yell into his ear, "Take him in this round, and there's an extra $2,000. This, Tadeo hears. The jackal lost the first round, so like many fighters, he starts pressing in the second round. He wants to get inside, to get his wiry arms fixed into some manner of vile death grip, but Tadeo reads him perfectly. 30 seconds in, Tadeo does a classic left-right-left combo and knocks his opponent squarely onto his butt. Tadeo then makes a common mistake as he attempts to launch himself like an idiot onto the jackal, much like a manic dive bomber lunging for the kill. The jackal manages to kick with his right foot, a brutal blow that hits Tadeo just above the crotch. He stays on his feet as the jackal scrambles to his, and for a second or two, neither man pushes the action. They finally shake it off and begin circling. Tadeo finds his boxer's rhythm and begins peppering the jackal with unanswered jabs. He opens a cut above his right eye and widens it with a relentless barrage. The jackal has the bad habit of throwing a wild fake left hook just before he ducks and comes in low at the knees, and he tries this one time too often. Tadeo reads it, times it perfectly, and executes his finest trick, a blind elbow spin, a move that takes balls because for a split second, his back is turned to his opponent. But the jackal is too slow, and Tadeo's right elbow crushes into the right jaw. Lights out. The jackal is out before he lands on the mat. The rules allow Tadeo to pounce on him for a few shots to the face, to properly finish him off. But why bother? Tadeo just stands in the center of the ring, hands raised, staring down, admiring his work as the jackal lies as still as a corpse. The referee is quick to stop it all. Somewhat nervously, we wait a few moments as they try and revive him. The crowd wants a stretcher, a casualty, something to talk about at work, but the jackal eventually comes to life and starts talking. He sits up and we relax, or try to. It's not easy staying calm in the aftermath of such furious action, when you have something at stake, and when 5,000 maniacs are stomping their feet. The jackal gets to his feet, and the maniacs boo. Tadeo walks over to him, says something nice, and they make peace. As we leave the cage, I follow Tadeo and smile as he slaps hands with his fans and soaks up another win. He made a couple of boneheaded moves that would get him killed against a ranked opponent, but all in all, it was another promising fight. I try and savor the moment and think about the future and the potential earnings, maybe some sponsorships. He's the fourth fighter I've invested in, and the first one who's paying off. Just before we leave the floor and enter the tunnel, a female voice yells, "Mr. Rudd! Mr. Rudd!" It takes a second or two for this to register because no one in this crowd should possibly recognize me. I'm wearing an official Team Zapata trucker-style wrap cap, a hideous yellow jacket, and different eyeglasses, and my long hair is tucked away. But by the time I pause and look, she's reaching for me. A heavy-set woman of 25, with purple hair, piercings, enormous boobs exploding from just under a skin-tight t-shirt, pretty much the typical classy gal at the cage fights. I give her a curious look, and she again says, "Mr. Rudd, aren't you Mr. Rudd, the lawyer?" I nod. She takes a step even closer and says, "My mother is on the jury." "What jury?" I ask, suddenly panicked. "There's only one jury at the moment."
We're from Milo, the Gardy Baker trial. My mom's on the jury.
I jerk my head to the left as if to say, that way. Seconds later, we're off the floor and walking side by side along a narrow corridor as the walls shake around us.
What's her name?
I ask, watching everyone who passes.
Glenna Roston, juror number 8.
Okay. I know every juror's name, age, race, job, education, family, residence, marital history, prior jury service, and criminal record, if any. I helped select them. Some I wanted, most I did not. I have been sitting in a packed courtroom with them 5 days a week for the past 2 weeks, and I'm really getting tired of them. I think I know their politics, religions, biases, and feelings about criminal justice. Because I know so damn much, I've been convinced since they were seated that Gardy Baker is headed for death row.
What's Glenna thinking these days?
I ask cautiously. She could be wearing a mic. Nothing surprises me.
She thinks they're all a bunch of liars.
We're still walking, slowly, going nowhere, each afraid to look the other in the eyes. I am stunned to hear this. Reading her body language and knowing her background, I would bet the farm that Glenna Roston would be the first to yell, guilty. I look behind us to make sure there's no witness, then say,
well, she's a smart woman because they are lying. They have no proof.
Do you want me to tell her that?
I don't care what you tell her, I say, looking around as we stop and wait for one of the heavyweights to pass with his entourage. I have $2,000 on the guy. I'm up $6,000 for the night, and I'm feeling pretty good. And to top it off, I'm hearing the shocking news that not all of my Gardy Baker jurors are brain dead. I ask, is she alone or does she have buddies?
She says they're not discussing the case.
I want to laugh at this. If she's not discussing the case, then how does this cutie know how her mother's leaning? At this precise moment, I am violating the rules of ethics and perhaps a criminal statute as well. This is unauthorized contact with a juror, and though it's not clear-cut and not instigated by me, there's no doubt it would be interpreted badly by the State Bar Association. And Judge Kaufman would blow a gasket. Tell her to stick to her guns, because they've got the wrong guy, I say, and walk away. I don't know what she wants, and there is nothing I can give her. I guess I could take 10 minutes and point out the glaring deficiencies in the state's evidence, but that would require her to absorb it all correctly, and then give an accurate report to her mother. Fat chance. This gal is here for the fights. I take the nearest stairway to a lower level, and as soon as I'm safely away from her, I duck into a restroom and replay what she said. I still can't believe it. That jury, along with the rest of the town, convicted my client the day he was arrested. Her mother, Glenna Roston, gives every indication of being the model Milo citizen, uneducated, narrow-minded, and determined to be a heroine for her community in its time of need. Monday morning will be interesting. At some point, after we resume testimony, I'll get the chance to glance into the jury box. So far, Glenna has not been afraid to return my looks. Her eyes will reveal something, though I'm not sure what. I shake it off and return to reality. The heavyweight fight lasts for a full 40 seconds, with my favorite still standing. I can't wait to reconvene with my little gang. We meet in the same dark room with the door locked, and the trash talk is brutal. All 6 of us pull cash from our pockets. Frankie has the notes and keeps it all straight. For the evening, I've netted $8,000 from my wagers, though $2,000 of this will go to Tadeo for his impromptu bonus. I'll get it back from his cut of the purse. That will go on the books for IRS purposes. This cash will not. Tadeo earns $8,000 for his efforts, a great night that will allow him to add another gang member to his entourage. He'll pay some bills, keep the family afloat, save nothing. I've tried to offer financial advice, but it's a waste of time. I stop by the locker room, hand over the $2,000, tell him I love him, and leave the arena. Partner and I go to a quiet bar and have some drinks. It takes a couple to settle me down. When you're that close to the action, and you've got your own hitter in the ring 2 seconds away from a concussion or a broken bone, and 5,000 idiots are screaming into your ears, your heart races wildly as your stomach flips and your nerves tingle. There's a flood of adrenaline like nothing I've ever felt. Chapter 8. Jack Peely is a former boyfriend of the mother of the two Fentress girls. Their father was long gone when they were murdered, and their mother's apartment was a revolving door for local tomcats and slimeballs. Peely lasted about a year and got the boot when she met a used tractor dealer with a little cash and a house without wheels. She moved up, and Peely moved out, with a broken heart. He was the last person seen near the girls when they disappeared. Early on, I asked the police why they did not treat him as a suspect, or at least investigate him, and their lame response was that they already had their man. Guardy was in custody and confessing right and left. I strongly suspect Jack Peely killed the girls in some sick act of revenge, and if the cops had not stumbled onto Guardy, they might have eventually questioned Peely. Guardy, though, with his frightening appearance, satanic leanings, and history of sexual perversion, became the clear favorite, and Milo has never looked back. According to the bishop, who is relying on his low-life sources, Peely hangs out almost every Saturday night at a joint called the Blue and White. It's about a mile east of Milo, and was originally a truck stop. Now it's just a redneck dive with cheap beer, pool tables, and live music on the weekends. On Saturday night, we ease into the gravel parking lot at around 10, and the place is packed, wall-to-wall pickups. We have our own, a rented Dodge club cab with Ram power and big tires, perhaps a bit too shiny for this joint, but then it belongs to Hertz, not me. Behind the wheel, partner is pretending to be a redneck, but is a pathetic excuse for one. He's ditched his daily black garb and is wearing jeans and a cowboy t-shirt. But it's not working. "Let's do it," I say from the front passenger seat. Tadeo and Miguel jump from the rear seat and casually walk through the front door. They're met just inside by a bouncer who wants $10 each for the cover. He looks them over and does not approve. They are, after all, darker-skinned Hispanics. But at least they're not black. According to the bishop, the Blue and White will tolerate a few Mexicans, but a black face would start a riot. Not that there's anything to worry about. Such a cracker dive has zero appeal to any sensible black guy. But a riot is what they'll get anyway. Tadeo and Miguel order a beer at the crowded bar and do a passable job blending in. They get some stares, but nothing bad. If these fat, drunk rednecks only knew. Tadeo could take out any five with his bare hands in less than a minute. Miguel, his brother and sparring partner, could take out four. After 15 minutes of surveying the crowd and getting the layout, Tadeo flags a bartender over and says in unaccented English, "Say, I need to get some money to a guy named Jack Peely, but I'm not sure I can recognize him." The bartender, a busy man, nods to a row of booths near the pool table and says, "Third booth, the guy with the black cap on." "Thanks." "No problem." They order another beer and kill some time. In Peely's booth there are two women and one other man. The table is covered with empty beer bottles and all four are chomping away on roasted peanuts. Part of the ambiance of the Blue and White is that you toss your empty shells onto the floor. At the far end a band cranks up and a dozen folks ease that way for a dance. Evidently Peely is not a dancer. Tadeo sends me a text. JP spotted. Waiting. They kill some more time. Partner and I sit and watch and wait, nervous as hell. Who can predict the outcome of a brawl in a room full of drunken idiots, half of whom carry NRA membership cards? Peely and his buddy head to a pool table and get ready for a game. Their women stay in the booth, eating peanuts, swilling beer. "Here we go," Tadeo says, and drifts away from the bar. He walks between two pool tables, times it perfectly, and bumps hard into Peely, who's minding his own business and chalking up his cue.
"What the hell?"
Peely yells angrily, hot-faced, and ready to kick a wetback's ass. before he can swing his cue, Tadeo hits him with three punches that no one can possibly see. Left, right, left, each landing on an eyebrow, where the cuts are always easier, each drawing blood. Peely goes down hard, and it will be a while before he wakes up. The women scream, and there's the usual rumble of activity and loud voices as a melee unfolds. Peely's friend is slow to react, but finally pulls back his stick to take off Tadeo's head. Miguel, though, intervenes and lands a hard fist at the base of his skull. Peely's friend joins Peely on the floor. Tadeo pounds Peely's face a few more times for good measure, then ducks low and darts into the men's restroom. A beer bottle cracks and splashes just above his head. Miguel is right behind him, angry voices calling after them. They lock the door, then scramble through a window. They're back in the pickup seconds later, and we casually drive away. "Got it," Tadeo says eagerly from the back seat. He thrusts his right hand forward, and it is indeed covered with blood. Peely's blood. We stop at a burger place, and I carefully scrape it clean. It's midnight before we make it back to the city. Chapter 9. The monster who killed the Fentress girls bound their ankles and wrists together with their shoelaces, then threw them in a pond. During Jenna's autopsy, a single strand of long black hair was found wrapped up in the laces around her ankles. Both she and Rayleigh had light blonde hair. At the time, Guardy had long black hair, though the color changed monthly, and not surprisingly, the state's hair analysis expert testified that there was a match. For over a century, true experts have known that hair analysis is wildly inaccurate. It is still used by authorities, even the FBI, when there's no better proof and the suspect has to be nailed. I begged Judge Kaufman to order DNA testing with a sample of Guardy's current hair, but he refused, said it was too expensive. We're talking about a man's life. When I was finally allowed to view the state's evidence, of which there was virtually none, I managed to steal about 3/4 of an inch of the black hair. No one missed it. Early Monday morning, I shipped by overnight parcel the hair and the sample of Jack Peely's blood to a DNA lab in California. It will cost me $6,000 for a rush job. I'll bet the ranch I find the real killer. Chapter 10. Partner and I speed away to Milo for another grueling week of lies. I'm eager to get my first glance at Glenna Roston, juror number 8, and see if there are any telltale signs of backdoor communications. Typically, though, things do not go as planned. The courtroom is once again packed, and I marvel at the crowd. For the 11th court day in a row, Julie Fentress, the mother of the twins, sits on the front bench, directly behind the prosecutor's table. She's with her support group, and they glare at me as if I killed the girls myself. When Trotz finally arrives and opens his briefcase and goes through the motions of pretending to be of some value, I lean down and tell him, "Watch juror number 8, Glenna Roston, but don't get caught." Trotz will get caught because Trotz is a blockhead. He should be able to covertly glance at the jurors and gauge their reactions, study their body language, see if they're awake or interested or pissed, do all the things you learn to do in a trial when you're curious about your jury. But Trotz checked out weeks ago. Guardy is in relatively good spirits. He's told me he enjoys the trial because it gets him out of his cell. They keep him locked down in solitary, usually with the lights off, because they know he killed the Fentress twins, and the harsh punishment should start now. My spirits are better because Guardy took a shower over the weekend. We kill some time waiting for Judge Kaufman. Hoover, the prosecutor, is not at his table at 9:15. His gang of Hitler Youth assistants have deeper frowns than usual. Something is going on. A bailiff appears and whispers to me, "Judge Kaufman wants to see you in chambers." This happens almost every day, it seems. We run back to chambers to fistfight over something we want to keep away from the public. But why bother? After 2 weeks, I know that if Hoover wants the crowd to see or hear something, It's going to happen. I walk into an ambush. The court reporter is there, ready to capture it all. Judge Kaufman is pacing, in his shirt and tie, robe and coat hanging on the door. Hoover stands smug and grim-faced by a window. The bailiff shuts the door behind me, and Kaufman throws some papers on the table.
"Read this," he growls.
"Good morning, Judge," I say, as smart-ass as possible. "Hoover?" They do not respond. It's a 2-page affidavit in which the deponent, or in this case, the liar, claims she bumped into me the previous Friday night at the MMA fights in the city, and that I discussed the case with her and told her to tell her mother, a juror, that the state had no evidence and all their witnesses were lying. She signed it Marlo Wilfang before a notary public.
"Any truth to it, Mr. Rudd?"
Kaufman growls, really steamed up.
"Oh, a little, I suppose."
"You want to tell your side of the story?"
he asks, obviously not ready to believe a word I say. Hoover mumbles loud enough to be heard.
"Clear case of jury tampering."
To which I snap, "You want to hear my side first, or you want to string me up without all the facts, same as Guardy?" Judge Kaufman says,
"That's enough. Knock it off, Mr. Hoover."
I tell my version, accurately, perfectly, without a single word of embellishment. I make the point that I've never met this woman, wouldn't know her from Eve, how could I? And that she deliberately sought me out, initiated the contact, then couldn't wait to hustle back home to Milo and try to insert herself into this trial. Often it takes a village to properly convict a killer. Almost yelling, I say,
"She says here I initiated contact. How? I don't know this woman. She knows me because she's been in the courtroom watching the trial. She can recognize me. How am I supposed to recognize her? Does this make any sense?"
It doesn't, of course, but Hoover and Kaufman won't budge. They are convinced they have me nailed. Their hatred of me and my client is so intense they can't see the obvious. I hammer away.
"She's lying, okay? She deliberately planned all of this. She bumped into me, had a conversation, then prepared this affidavit, probably in your office, Hoover, and she is lying. That's perjury and contempt of court. Do something, Judge."
"I don't need you to tell me."
"Oh, come on. Get up off your ass and do the right thing for a change."
"Listen, Mr. Rudd,"
he says, red-faced and ready to take a swing at me. I want a mistrial at this point. I want to provoke these two into doing something really stupid. Loudly, I say,
"I want a hearing. Keep the jury out. Call this fine young lady to the witness stand and let me cross-examine her. She wants to get involved in this trial? Bring her on. Her mother is obviously biased and unstable, and I want her off the jury."
"What did you say to her?" Kaufman asked.
"I just told you word for word. I told her the same thing I would say to any other person on the face of this earth. Your case is built on nothing but a bunch of lying witnesses, and you have no credible proof. Period."
"You've lost your mind," Hoover says.
"I want a hearing," I practically yell. "I want this woman off the jury, and I will not proceed with the trial until she's gone."
"Are you threatening me?"
Kaufman asks as things spin rapidly out of control.
"No, sir. I am promising you. I will not continue."
"Then I'll hold you in contempt and throw you in jail."
"I've been there before. Do it, and we'll have ourselves a mistrial. We can come back in 6 months and have this party all over again."
They don't know for sure that I've been in jail, but at this moment, they figure I'm not lying. A fringe lawyer like me is constantly flirting with ethical boundaries. Jail time is a badge of honor. If I'm forced to anger a judge or humiliate him, so be it. We go silent for a few minutes. The court reporter stares at her feet, and if given the chance, she would sprint from the room, knocking over chairs in the process. At this point, Hoover is terrified of a reversal, of having his great conviction frowned upon by an appellate court that sends it back for another trial. He doesn't want to relive this ordeal. What he wants is that glorious date in the future when he drives, probably with a reporter in the car with him, to a prison called Big Wheeler, where the state keeps its death house. He'll be treated like royalty because he will be the man, the gunslinger who solved the hideous crime and secured the guilty verdict that sent Guardy Baker to his execution, thus allowing Milo to have its closure. He'll be given a front-row seat behind a curtain that will be dramatically pulled aside to reveal Guardy lying on a gurney with tubes in his arms. Afterward, he, Hoover, will find the time to chat somberly with the press and describe the burdens his office places upon him. He has yet to witness an execution, and in this death-happy state, that's worse than being a 30-year-old virgin. State v. Guardy Baker is Dan Hoover's finest hour. It will make his career. He'll get to speak at those all-important prosecutors' conferences held in cheap casinos. He'll get reelected. At the moment, though, he's sweating because he has overplayed his hand. They were convinced they had me by the balls. What foolishness. Nailing me with some bogus improper contact charge will not help their case and cause at this point. It's overkill, and it's not unusual. They have Guardy all but convicted and sentenced to die, and for fun, they thought it would be cute to take a bite out of me.
"Smells like improper contact to me, Judge," Hoover says, trying to be dramatic.
"It would," I say.
"Let's deal with it later," Kaufman says. "The jury is waiting."
I say, "I guess you guys are deaf. I'm not proceeding until I get a hearing. I insist on getting this into the record." Kaufman looks at Hoover, and both seem to lose air. They know I'm crazy enough to go on strike, refuse to participate in the trial, and when that happens, they are staring at a mistrial. The judge glares at me and says,
"I hold you in contempt."
"Put me in jail," I say, mocking, taunting. The court reporter is getting every word. "Put me in jail." But he can't do it right now. He has to make a decision, and a wrong one could jeopardize everything. If I go to jail over this, the entire trial is hijacked, and there's really no way to save it. Somewhere down the road, an appellate court, most likely a federal one, will review Kaufman's exact movements right here and call a foul. Guardy has to have a lawyer, a real one, and they simply cannot proceed with me in jail. They've handed me a gift. A few seconds pass, and tempers cool. Helpfully, almost sweetly, I say, "Look, Judge, you can't deny me a hearing on this. To do so is to hand me some heavy ammo for the appeal."
"What kind of hearing?" he says, cracking.
"I want this woman, this Marla Wilfang, on the witness stand in a closed hearing. You guys are hell-bent on nailing me with improper contact, so let's get to the bottom of it. I have the right to defend myself. Send the jury home for the day, and let's have us a brawl."
"I'm not sending the jury home," he says as he falls into his chair, defeated.
"Fine. Keep them locked up all day. I don't care. This gal has lied to you, and in doing so, she stuck her nose into the middle of this trial. There's no way her mother can stay on the jury. It's grounds for a mistrial now, and it's damn sure grounds for a reversal 5 years from now. Pick your poison." They are listening because they are suddenly frightened and woefully inexperienced. I've gotten the mistrials. I've gotten the reversals. I've been here many times in the center of the arena where death is on the line, and one mistake can ruin a case. They are novices. Kaufman has presided over 2 capital murder trials in the 7 years he's been on the bench. Hoover has sent only one man to death row, an embarrassment for any prosecutor around here. 2 years ago, he bungled a death case so badly, the judge, not Kaufman, was forced to declare a mistrial. The charges were later dismissed. They are in over their heads, and they have just blundered badly. "Who prepared the affidavit?" I ask. No response. I say, "Look, the language used here definitely came from a lawyer. No layperson speaks like this. Did your office prepare it, Hoover?" Hoover, trying to remain cool but now far beyond desperate, says something that not even Kaufman can believe.
"Judge, we can continue with trots while Mr. Rudd sits over in the jail."
I burst out laughing as Kaufman looks like he's been slapped.
"Oh, go right ahead," I say, taunting. "You've managed to botch this case from the first day. Just go ahead and award Guardy with a reversal."
Kaufman says,
No. Mr. Trotz has said nothing so far, and it would be wise if that boy just continues sitting there with that stupid look on his face.
While this is funny, I look hard at His Honor and then hard at the court reporter who's capturing it all.
Strike that!
Kaufman barks at her as he catches himself. What a moron! A trial often resembles a bad circus as various acts spin out of control. What began as a fun-and-games attempt to humiliate me now looks like a terrible idea, at least for them. I don't want Hoover coming up with any good ideas, not that I have much to worry about, and so to keep him off balance, I throw some gas on the fire by saying, Of all the stupid things you've said so far in this trial, that has got to be the winner. Benny Trotz, what a joke! You would want him in the first chair.
What's your position, Mr. Rudd?
Kaufman demands. I'm not walking back into that courtroom until we have a hearing on improper contact with juror number 8, the lovely Mrs. Glenna Roston. If I'm really in contempt, then throw me in jail. Right now, I'd rather have a mistrial than a triple orgasm.
No need to be crude, Mr. Rudd.
Hoover begins fidgeting and stammering.
Well, Judge, I suppose we could deal with the improper contact and the contempt later, you know, after the trial or something. Me, I'd just rather get on with the testimony. This, just seems so unnecessary at this point.
Then why'd you start it, Hoover? I say. Why did you clowns get all excited about improper contact when you knew damned well this Wilfang woman is lying?
Don't call me a clown! Judge Kaufman sneers.
Sorry, Judge, I wasn't referring to you. I was referring to all the clowns in the prosecutor's office, including the district attorney himself.
If we could elevate the level of discourse here, Kaufman says.
My apologies, I say, about as sarcastically as humanly possible. Hoover retreats to the window where he stares onto the rows of shabby buildings that comprise the main street of Milo. Kaufman retreats to a bookcase behind his desk, where he stares at books he's never touched. The air is strained and tense. A weighty decision must be made, and quickly, and if His Honor gets it wrong, the aftershocks will ripple for years. He finally turns around and says,
I guess we'd better question juror number 8, but we're not doing it out there. We'll conduct the inquiry here.
What follows is one of those episodes in a trial that frustrate litigants, jurors, and observers. We spend the rest of the day in Judge Kaufman's less than spacious chambers, haggling and often yelling over the ins and outs of my improper contact with a juror. Glenna Roston is dragged in, put under oath, and is almost too terrified to speak. She begins lying immediately when she says she has not discussed this case with her family. On cross-examination, I attack with a vengeance that seems to astonish even Kaufman and Hoover. She leaves the room sobbing. Next, they drag in her daffy daughter, Ms. Marlowe Wilfang, who repeats her little narrative under the clumsy questioning of Dan Hoover, who's really off his game now. When she's handed over to me, I sweetly walk her down the golden path, then slice her throat from ear to ear. Within 10 minutes, she's crying, gasping for breath, and wishing 1,000 times she'd never called my name at the arena. It becomes painfully obvious she's lying in her affidavit. Even Judge Kaufman asks her,
In a crowd of 5,000 people, how did Mr. Rudd find you if he's never met you before?
Thank you, Judge. That would be the great question. As her story goes, she came home from the fights late on Friday. When she finally woke up on Saturday, she called her mother, who immediately called Mr. Dan Hoover, who knew exactly what to do. They met in his office on Sunday afternoon, worked out the language for the affidavit, and presto, Hoover was in business. I call Hoover as a witness. He objects. We argue, but Kaufman has no choice. I question Hoover for an hour, and 2 bobcats trapped in the same burlap sack would be much more civilized. One of his assistants wrote every word of the affidavit. One of his secretaries typed it. Another secretary notarized it. He then questions me, and the squabbling continues. Throughout this tedious ordeal, The jurors wait in the deliberation room, no doubt briefed by Glenna Roston, and no doubt blaming me for another frustrating delay in the trial. As if I care. I keep reminding Kaufman and Hoover that they are playing with a cobra here. If Glenna Roston stays on the jury, I'm guaranteed a reversal. I'm not sure of this. On appeal, nothing is guaranteed. But I gradually see them wither under the strain and doubt their own judgment. I repeatedly move for a mistrial. The motions are repeatedly denied. I don't care. It's in the record. Late in the afternoon, Kaufman decides to excuse Mrs. Roston and replace her with Ms. Maisie, one of our Blue Ribbon alternates. Ms. Maisie is no replacement to get excited about. In fact, she's no better than the last old gal who occupied her chair. No one in Milo would be better. You could select 12 from a pool of 1,000, and every jury would look and vote the same. So why did I burn so much clock today? To hold them accountable. To scare the hell out of them with the scenario that they, prosecutor and judge, duly elected by the locals, could screw up the most sensational case this backwater hick town has ever seen. To collect ammunition for the appeal. And to make them respect me. I demand that Marla Wilfang be prosecuted for perjury, but the prosecutor is tired. I demand she be held in contempt. Instead, Judge Kaufman reminds me that I'm in contempt. He sends for a bailiff, one with handcuffs. I say, I'm sorry, Judge, but I've forgotten why you found me in contempt. It was so long ago.
Because you refused to continue the trial this morning, and because we've wasted an entire day back here fighting over a juror. Plus, you insulted me.
There are so many ways to respond to this nonsense, but I decide to let it pass. Tossing me in jail over a contempt charge will only complicate matters for them, for the authorities, and it will give me even more ammo for Gardy's appeal. A large deputy comes in, and Kaufman says,
"Take him to jail."
Hoover is at the window, his back to it all. I don't want to go to jail, but I can't wait to get out of this room. It's beginning to reek of stale body odor. The handcuffs are locked around my wrists, hands in front, not back, and as I'm led away, I look at Kaufman and say, I'm assuming I will be allowed to continue as lead counsel in the morning.
You will.
To frighten them even more, I add, the last time I was tossed in jail in the middle of a trial, the conviction was reversed by the state Supreme Court. 9-0. You clowns should read your cases. Another large deputy joins our little parade. They take me through the back doors and down the rear hallway I use every day. For some reason, we pause on a landing as the deputies mumble into their radios. When we finally step outside, I get the impression that word was leaked. A cheer goes up by my haters when they see me frog-marched out, handcuffed. For no apparent reason, the cops stall as they try to decide which patrol car to use. I stand by one, exposed, smiling at my little mob. I see partner and yell that I'll call him later. He is stunned and confused. For sport, they shove me into the same back seat with Gardy. Lawyer and client off to jail. As we pull away, with lights and sirens fully engaged to give this miserable town as much drama as possible, Gardy looks at me and says,
"Where you been all day?"
I'm not about to try. I lift my bound hands and say,
"Fighting with the judge. Guess who won?" "How can they throw a lawyer in jail?"
"The judge can do whatever he wants."
"You getting the death penalty too?"
I chuckle for the first time in many hours. No, not yet anyway. Gardy is amused by this unexpected change in routine. He says,
"You're gonna love the food there."
I'll bet. The two deputies in the front seat are listening so hard they're barely breathing.
"You ever been in jail before?"
my client asks.
"Oh yes, several times.
I have a knack for pissing off judges."
"How'd you piss off Judge Kaufman?"
"It's a long story."
"Well, we got all night, don't we?"
"I suppose we do, though I doubt they'll throw me in the same cell with my dear client." Minutes later, we stop in front of a 1950s-style flat-roofed building with several additions stuck to its sides like malignant tumors. I've been here a few times to meet with Guardy, and it's a miserable place. We park. They yank us out of the car and jostle us inside a cramped open room where some cops lounge around pushing paper and acting like badasses. Guardy disappears into the rear, and when an unseen door opens, I can hear prisoners yelling in the background. "Judge Kaufman said I can make 2 phone calls," I snap at the jailer as he moves toward me. He stops, uncertain as to what exactly a jailer is supposed to do when confronting an angry lawyer sent over for contempt. He backs away. I call Judith, and after barking at her receptionist, then her secretary, then her paralegal, I get her on the phone. Explain I'm in jail again and need help. She curses, reminds me of how busy she is, then says all right. I call partner and give him the update. They hand me an orange jumpsuit with Milo City Jail stenciled across the back. I change in a filthy bathroom, carefully arranging my shirt, tie, and suit on one hanger. I hand it to the jailer and say, "Please don't wrinkle this. I have to wear it tomorrow." "You want it pressed?" he says, then roars with laughter. The others break down too at this real knee-slapper, and I smile like a good sport. When the laughing is over, I say, "So, what's for dinner?" The jailer says, "It's Monday, spam day. Always spam on Monday." "Can't wait." My cell is a 10x10 concrete bunker that reeks of stale urine and body odor. On the bunk beds are 2 young black men, one reading, the other napping. There is no third bed, so I'll sleep in a plastic chair stained with dark brown splotches. My 2 new cellies do not appear the least bit friendly. I don't want to fight, but getting beat up in jail in the middle of a capital murder defense would cause an automatic mistrial. I'll ponder it. Because she's done this before, Judith knows exactly what to do. At 5 p.m., she files a petition for habeas corpus in federal court in the city, with an urgent demand for an immediate hearing. I love federal court, most of the time. She also sends a copy of her petition to my favorite reporter at the newspaper. I'll make as much noise as possible. Kaufman and Hoover have blundered badly, and they'll pay for it. The reader on the bottom bunk decides he wants to talk, so I explain why I'm here. He thinks it's funny, a lawyer in jail for pissing off the judge. The napper on the top bunk rolls over and joins the fun. Before long, I'm giving legal advice, and these guys need as much as I can dish out. An hour later, a jailer fetches me with the news that I have a visitor. I follow him through a maze of narrow hallways and find myself in a cramped room with a breathalyzer. This is where they bring the drunk drivers. The bishop stands and we shake hands. We've spoken on the phone but never met. I thank him for coming but caution him about doing so. He says screw it. He's not afraid of the locals. Plus, he knows how to lie low and stay under the radar. He also knows the police chief, the cops, the judge, the usual small-town crap. He says he's tried to call Hoover and Kaufman to tell them they've made a big mistake, but he can't get through. He's leaning on the police chief to put me in a better cell. The more we talk, the more I like the guy. He's a street fighter, a worn-out, frazzled old goat who's been knocking heads with the cops for decades. He hasn't made a dime and doesn't care. I wonder if I'll be him in 20 years. "How about the DNA tests?" he asks. "The lab will get the samples tomorrow, and they've promised a quick turnaround." "And if it's Peely?" "All hell breaks loose." This guy is on my side, but I don't know him. We chat for 10 minutes, and he says goodbye. When I return to my cell, my 2 new friends have spread the word that there's a criminal lawyer in here with them. Before long, I'm yelling advice up and down the block. Chapter 11. Common sense is not always my strong suit, but I decide not to start a fight with Fonzo and Frog, my 2 new partners in crime. Instead, I sit in my chair all night and try to nap. It doesn't work. I said no to the spam for dinner and no to the putrid eggs and cold toast for breakfast. Thankfully, no one mentions a shower. They bring me my suit, shirt, tie, shoes, and socks, and I dress quickly. I say goodbye to my cellies, both of whom will be behind bars for several years, regardless of the brilliant advice I dispensed for hours. Guardy and I are given separate rides back to the courthouse. A larger crowd of enemies jeer at me as I'm sort of dragged out of the car, still in handcuffs. Once I'm inside and away from any photographers, they remove the handcuffs. Partner is waiting in the hallway. I made the morning edition of the Chronicle, the city's daily. Metro section, third page. No big deal. Rudd is thrown in jail again. As instructed, I follow a bailiff back into the chambers of Judge Kaufman, who's waiting with Hoover. Both wear smirks and are curious to see how I survived the night. I do not mention the jail, do not acknowledge the fact that I've not slept, eaten, or showered in a long time. I'm in one piece, raring to go, and this seems to irritate them. It's all fun and games, with Guardy's life on the line. Seconds after I step into chambers, another bailiff rushes in and says, "Sorry, Judge, but there's a U.S. Marshal out here says you got to be in federal court in the city at 11 this morning. You too, Mr. Hoover." "What the hell?" Kaufman says. Oh, so helpfully, I explain. "It's a habeas corpus hearing, Judge. My lawyers filed it yesterday afternoon. An emergency hearing to get me out of jail.